Good morning. So last time we talked about issues related to looking at code and figuring out, well, what's the cache going to do here? And so one thing we want to talk about is, well, we have some C code which accesses say an array. We want to figure out where might there be conflicts, or otherwise, how do we reason about how the cache is being used? And sort of the key idea for quickly looking at that is to know that if we know our cache configuration, we know that things that map to the same set are a certain distance apart, and that's the number of bytes per way apart from each other. And those things that map to the same set, well, the set can only hold so many things. If we have a four-way cache, can only hold four things. So once we've accessed four things that map to the same set, we have to get rid of something. So if we look at, say, a loop and we find out, oh, this loop accesses set zero, then set zero again, then set zero again, then set zero again, then it tries to access that first thing it was accessing, you can reason about, is that going to still be in the cache or not, based on this. And you can go just look at one particular set and probably find a pattern that applies to all the accesses. And we also talked about sort of a more heuristic strategy for limiting sort of cache misses, which is focused not on conflict misses, but on mostly capacity misses. This was cache blocking. This was particularly for matrix-like code. We dealt with matrix-like code because that's very commonly the sort of code which has problems with caches. They have a lot of data. You have a lot of data. One of the ways you can have a lot of data is that you have data that is not one-dimensional. And our intuition there was we wanted to maximize the amount of work per cache miss. That we reordered our operations. We didn't change the calculation we were doing. We did the same calculation, but we made it so whenever we had something which made there be a cache miss, that means we accessed a value, we had an access for a while. We made sure we did as much as reasonably possible with that value, with the caveat that we sort of had to balance that we're working with multiple values. You want to make good use of all of them. And usually our naive code ended up having like one value which we made great use of, and all the other values we didn't. Cache blocking, we get to this sort of compromise. And I'll review that a bit in a second. So first, some logistics so I don't forget. So there's an exam next week. The exam includes up to and including this lecture. Probably have a little less coverage of the topics in this lecture because, and cache blocking, just because we have an assignment on those after the exam, and we'll save our harder questions until then. Also, I know that for Pipe Homework 2, which is traditionally the most difficult assignment for students in this class, office hours moved very slowly, and I would like to think about fixing that in future semesters. Not much I can do now. I had some ideas. I'm not sure whether you think they work out. Like maybe we could have held office hours where we like try to explain things to a group if people are having conceptual problems. I just don't know how often that would help versus like looking at your particular, what your code is doing. Maybe there's some way my error output could be better. Maybe I should make the office hour queue disincentivize the operation of going on the queue without having a question, which we don't like, but we know many of you do. Or some other things about like I know that we have some students who like make a lot of effort to find their problem, and that's great. So they have a good question for the TAs, and some students who, when the TA talks to them, I hear that, well, they just know they are failing a test. They haven't looked at the test, Maybe there's something we can do to try to disincentivize that, because that's not the best use of RTA time. Okay. So that's logistics. So as I said, I'm going to review cache blocking since I know it's confusing and you're going to have an assignment where it might be useful after the exam. So one way of viewing what we're doing in cache blocking is by imagining, let's say, instead of writing code which just used values, we had to explicitly load values in the cache before we use them. If so, this is what our sort of original loop would look like. We'd have to say, I need AIK, I'm going to explicitly load it here, and it's going to stay loaded, until I move on to the next and I need BIJ and BKJ, and I'm going to load it here, and then I'm going to use it once and get rid of it. You know, so this is just, you know, annotating our code. You imagine this is what we might have to do if we hypothetically had a machine where instead of loads asking the cache for the value and going to memory, we had to manage our cache by hand. You know, we might imagine a hypothetical machine like that. People have seriously proposed machines that work that way, on the assumption that, hey, you could do a better job than the automatic management. But we're just doing it as a way of thinking about what's going to happen, because when you have your cache loads explicitly listed, it's easy to count how many times you're doing that. So when we do our blocking, in this case, just in K, we load a whole bunch of values into our cache. We load both the AIK and AIK plus 1 to our cache. We load the AKJ and AK plus 1J into the cache. That's what our explicit loads are. And then all those things we just loaded, so they'll be in the cache. And then we do the work. And we know this is OK to do, because certainly our cache can hold 5 values. At least we hope so. We hope there's not like conflict misses that keep that from happening, or else that would be really bad. And we can see that the efficiency from cache blocking, one way of viewing it, is before we had that inner code was doing one add and multiply, basically. And we did 2 loads for a loop. So here, this is this code. We load 2 values. We do a multiply and an add. So we had 2 loads for every multiply and add. Here, we load 3 values, and then we do 2 multiplies and 2 adds. So we're getting a better ratio of loading data to work. And sort of that's where our advantage from cache blocking is coming from. By reorganizing this so we use values more, for example, we use BIJ, which we load once more times than we were before, and we use even these AKJs a bit more than we did. No, we don't use that, but we use these values more than we were before, which is how we get the extra work. But we're getting, if we count the loads and the work, we have a better ratio of the two. So that's the reordering that the cache blocking does. And that's where the advantage comes. So that's one way of viewing why this transformation is helping us, is that if we count the number of loads and the amount of work, the ratio gets better when we reorder our work to be more in these square blocks. So we have more reuse of values. So another way of looking at it is to just look at each type of value and say, what's the temporal and spatial locality? So here I have the blocked in K and I version that we saw last time. And we can see that before, we loaded this BI plus 0J, and we used it once. So before I did this blocking, I just have a loop, my innermost loop just has this, and then we move on to the next J. That was what happened before I did blocking. So here I'm accessing it once, and then not again for n squared iterations of my loop. So that means I have horrible temporal locality. One access, do it again. Here, I access it twice, and then not again for n squared-ish iterations of the loop until the next k. So I improve my temporal locality. So previously, my temporal locality was basically as bad as it could possibly be in these BIJs. Now it is a little better. Accessing only twice, not great, but it's a little better. But if we block with a higher value for k, we can make that a lot better. And we can do the same analysis for the AKJs. In this case, we have n iterations because we need to go to the next loop over i's. To the next I, we need to advance through all the j's. So that's n iterations to get back to the value. But we access it once previously, and then not again for n iterations. Now we access it twice, and then not again for n iterations. So we improve the temporal locality in these AKJs, where previously it was almost as bad as it could be. Not as bad as the BIJs, but pretty bad if our matrix was big, if n was like 10,000 or something like that. And we can also look at our AIKs. So previously, we accessed them n times, then never again. And here, it kind of looks the same. We're accessing them n times and never again. But it's actually a little worse locality because we have more accesses to other parts of AIK in the middle. So we're accessing them a little bit less frequently. We're getting about the same amount of reuse, assuming things fit in the cache. But from just our notion of temporal locality, the temporal locality is a little bit worse. It's not worse in a way which is going to matter, but it's a little worse because we're certainly not accessing a particular element that we specify with AIK as frequently as we were before. We have more stuff in between each access. So this temporal locality analysis makes sense. So, and in simple cases, which is usually not the case where you use cache blocking, if you do this this sort of what's my temporal locality like analysis, that's a good way to figure out, will my code be faster? It's not as straightforward with blocking because we have this sort of case where the temporal locality gets worse, but it's not obvious like whether that's too bad. Well, with 2, it's pretty obvious. If you have like 20 values, it's less obvious, right? Is that going to cause more cache misses? But there's this compromise. It just doesn't matter that we've reduced this locality, but eventually it will. Like if we make K and I big enough, then this loss of temporal locality will start mattering because we'll run out of space in our cache because we're accessing all these other parts of AIK in between. So cache blocking also improves spatial locality. And this didn't come out so much because it's not the primary reason we do cache blocking, but also improves spatial locality. And also hurts spatial locality. We have this compromise like we had before. So here we have our BIJs. So before, when we just had this as our innermost loop, we had perfect spatial locality for BIJ. We access BIJ, then we access BIJ plus 1. And if you remember that our accesses were actually to BI times N plus J, that when we add 1, we're just going to the next element in the big flat array. So those are actually next to each other in memory, which means that if it's not at the end of a cache block, they're in the same cache block. So we'll actually take advantage of that. Here, we have slightly less spatial locality because these BIJ and BI plus 1J are N elements apart in the big array. So that's not good spatial locality, that's bad. But it's not a big cost as long as we don't have too many of these, right? We have just 2, we can fit 2 things in the cache, even if they're far apart, take advantage of some spatial locality there, but it's not as good. But if we look at our other items, our AIK, previously we had very poor spatial locality. So while we were losing spatial locality in BIJ, and it turns out in AKJ, because previously we had the most perfect possible spatial locality, now we made it a little bit worse. In AIK, we previously had essentially no spatial locality. We advanced I first, so we accessed AIK a bunch of times, and then we advanced I, and that was far apart. Now, when we advance, because we have advancing I and K in the innermost loop a little bit, in particular K, we know that AIK and AIK plus 1, we're going to access together, and that's better spatial locality. We have at least a little bit of spatial locality in these values, where previously it was basically as bad as it could be. But the compromise is we made the spatial locality a little bit worse in BIJ and AKJ. So one way of looking at what cache blocking is doing is that by choosing the size of our blocks, we're making the sort of perfect locality we usually naturally have a little worse, but in exchange we're making everything have some locality everywhere, right? We have some locality in everything. It might not be always as good as we could possibly get, but we're not gonna have any cases of really bad locality by always working on blocks of data, so we have things next to each other for spatial locality, and we get to use values multiple times for temporal locality, where previously we get to have some values next to each other for spatial locality, but not all of them, and some values used multiple times for temporal locality, but not all of them. Okay. And this is why when we get to sort of our general picture, if we do our loading analysis, we see that we sort of have, you know, this, you know, when we choose K, J, and I, we can sort of balance the amount of locality. And this is sort of a formulaic way that we say we do n squared calculations in, or, yeah, we do n to the third calculations or so on in here. And you know, we can count sort of misses that way. I think that might be, but we can just look at sort of the compromise we're getting of how much work we get to do per load based on adjusting those parameters. And typically, it's going to turn out that when we reorder our calculations, we're, that square-ish chunks of work done together is going to give us the best trade-off. That might not always be the case. You can probably come up with some very artificial problem where that's not the case, but typically, if you just count the loads and misses, it's going to end up that a squarish chunk of work is going to be the best compromise as far as how much, how many loads we do versus how many calculations we do after those loads. We go back to that first analysis where we just counted explicit loads. Or if you, alternatively, if you look at the locality and everything, when you have squarish blocks, you'll probably say, hey, the locality, temporal and spatial locality in this is not like perfect, but it's pretty good, and that should be true for everything when you've done hash blocking. You'll say, yeah, there's some spatial locality, there's some temporal locality for every value. Okay. So questions about hash blocking? Okay, so we showed you some code for cache blocking, and Samira showed you some performance results that I got several semesters ago. And you may have noticed, if you were looking very carefully, that we did this little trick. So initially, we showed you cycles, like time. And then we started showing you cache misses. And you should be suspicious, wait, why aren't you showing me cycles? Isn't cycles what matters? And the nasty story is, well, that these are different. So this is miss rate for the correct loop order, unblocked code, no cache blocking, versus cache blocking with a reasonable block size, like a nice square block size. I chose the square size, so the stuff that we loaded into cache would fit in my, I think, L1 or L2. And this is what I got for probably L1, because these are L1 misses, and this is what I got for my miss rate. So you can see, except for some spikes, which are probably from those conflict misses, because it's like close to a power of 2, I got pretty good performance as far as cache misses. But that's not the same as sort of actual performance. So above, on the top, I have cycles per multiplier add. So that's just, so like, it should be, if we're getting the same efficiency, a flat line, you know, regardless of the problem size. That's why we're normalizing by the numbers of multiplies and adds. And this is what I got with my original code up here that we got. That the block code was worse. It was a bit worse, even though it had a lot less cache misses, a lot less. And the reason was that the cache misses didn't actually really matter compared to the extra calculations I was doing to figure out what the array indices were and manage all the loop indices. That ended up mattering more than the cost of those cache misses. Now, this doesn't hold true when I started using a more optimized loop. So here, the difference between the top and the bottom graph is, for the bottom graph, I tweaked optimization settings in my compiler for both the unblocked and blocked code to get a better version of the loop. And by optimizing things in the loop, which don't affect what memory addresses are accessed, we're still accessing memory in the exact same pattern, I got way better performance, and it turned out that my cache blocking code ended up helping down here. Cache blocking code ended up helping over here. My blocked performance ended up being a lower line when it got to big enough sizes. And it makes sense that it needs to be big enough because you have to think that it only matters when things don't kind of fit in the cache. Because when they sort of fit in the cache, we'll get most of the benefit of caching a lot of the time. Okay, so this picture, you know, looks kind of bad. Like, why are we spending so much time talking about a teeny performance gain, even when we do things exactly right? And if you don't do things exactly right, a performance loss. So where it really matters is with really huge sizes. So with really huge sizes, I see a benefit. And really huge means, on my system, that the size I choose is bigger than my L3 cache. And the L3 cache on the system where I was testing this is 8 megabytes. So once it didn't fit into my 8 megabyte L3 cache, then it started mattering. So when it fit in my L3 cache, yes, I had misses to the first level cache, but the L3 cache wasn't that slow. So it wasn't slow enough to make it matter. But when I started having misses in my L3 cache, then it really mattered, and we have this sort of almost twofold improvement. And this is often the story with cache blocking, that when you're doing it right, it will help improve performance in small sizes, but because we have like multiple levels of cache, you need to actually exhaust your cache to get the biggest benefit, because the biggest gap in performance is still going to be between going to a cache and no cache, typically. Could imagine systems which have caches where that doesn't work that way, but that's usually what happens, and you can see that here. I don't have as many points here as the previous graph, mainly because if you think about what a 4,000 by 4,000 matrix is and how many additions and multiplications I'm doing for that, it gets very slow. Okay. So we have this optimized version. So what did change between the less and more optimized version? And what I was optimizing was the arithmetic and the loop. So one thing that I got my compiler to do is reduce the number of loads. So you might say, well, that's affecting the access pattern. I wasn't loading less data. I was loading more data at once. I did larger loads. So that just lowered the number of instructions. I loaded multiple values with one instruction, which there are ways to do in x86. We will talk about them after the exam. And did adds and multiplies with less instructions. So that's one thing. You know, so I also had, there's more efficient ways of doing that. Then we'll talk about those after the exam. And I also got the address calculations to be simpler. So previously, the code was doing a lot of work to calculate addresses. I just rearranged the code to simplify that. So the question you might have is, well, why did this matter as much as it did? So we have cache misses. You know, why did we not see an effect regardless of this? Because you might say, well, before we did these optimizations, and after that, didn't we have the same number of cache misses roughly? And doing bigger loads is not going to reduce my cache misses, especially since my loads are still basically a cache block, in the same cache block. So how did this improve my performance? Because our notion of how our pipeline processor works is you have a cache miss, you stall. And all these things I'm doing here don't change the number of cache misses. Like, I'm still accessing the same memory, I still need to bring the same stuff into the cache, I should have the same number of cache misses. And with our pipeline processor, we'd stall every time we had a cache miss, so we'd lose the same amount of time on both the optimized and non-optimized version, and you still expect to see a performance difference. You wouldn't expect that it to be the case that it's faster when it's optimized versus not. But what's happening is that this is not how our modern processor works. Our modern processor does this multiple issue thing we talked about. It executes multiple instructions at once. It also does that out of order thing, and this matters here. So when we had lots of arithmetic work, we weren't waiting for the loads because we had enough arithmetic to hide the loads. So we had this long blocking load that went to our L2 cache, and we did a bunch of multiplies and adds, and they took longer than that load. And as long as they took longer, it didn't matter how long the load was. Just because we didn't need to have these multiplies and adds wait for the load. They just happened in parallel, and whichever set of operations finished first determined how fast our program was. It wasn't the case that because we had a load that missed in the cache, we had to wait for it. We had to wait for either it or the other operations in the program. And before we optimized these multiplies and adds, it didn't matter that how slow the load was because it wasn't slow enough. But when we made these multiplies and adds faster, shrinking that, then the loads were what was taking all our time. We loaded something, then we needed to load another thing, and another thing, and another thing, and that's what determined how fast things were. So what was happening is that the loop efficiency initially was my bottleneck. It determined my performance. If I wanted to count how long it took, I wouldn't count how long it took to load things from memory. I'd count what's the total amount of time I needed to do all this arithmetic. That determined my performance, because while we were doing that arithmetic, in parallel, the processor could do its loads. When I fixed that, now the processor couldn't do all that loads in parallel because the cache wasn't that fast, because we had all those misses. So then the cache performance became the bottleneck. And this is a common theme that you'll see anytime you're trying to make code fast. That you'll fix one thing that was determining how fast your code was, and now all of a sudden, something else that didn't matter before mattered. And this definitely happens a lot with caches. If when your calculations take long enough time, because our processor can do other work while it's having a cache miss, it can hide the size of that cache miss until you make that work a little faster. And this can happen with other operations. So any questions on this sort of trade-off thing, which we'll need to think about a lot when we're talking about, as we'll talk about for the rest of the day, a bunch of sort of general optimization techniques that are focused not on caches, but on this sort of loop efficiency. So I told you I used my compiler to do these loop optimizations. I didn't change the code. I fiddled with my compiler options to get my compiler to do something more aggressive than it was doing before. So let's talk about what compilers do when optimizing. And we might start with looking at sort of our silly unoptimized code. So remember, if you've ever looked at compiler output without optimization, most of our compilers commonly do really stupid things without optimization. They decide, okay, I'm going to store the pointer A on the stack, I'm going to add the offset with a separate instruction, get the value, add it to the sum which I store on the stack, add it to I which I store on the stack, then I'm going to, right after that, move I back into a register. You wouldn't write code this way. You wouldn't store all these values in the stack. You would do something more intelligent as far as using registers, at least also more intelligent and simpler, right? This is a lot of work to remember where everything is on the stack. We have enough space in registers, but compilers do something simple that always works. But of course, when we supply optimization options, our compiler might generate different code. So this is GCC 5.4 with -OS, which is optimized for size, which I like using because it produces short assembly code. Not necessarily the fastest assembly code, but short. And this does something more like what you might expect. It remembers, we can access an array element with this syntax in x86, where we specify a base and an index and a thing to multiply by. It remembers that and uses that. It's, compact just sets, uses registers for everything. It, sums into the return value at register directly. So it does all these tricks. So the compiler has done a lot of things that would be really tedious to do by hand. It does a pretty good job. And you may know that there are other optimization options, so which somewhat improve things. And the compiler does some surprisingly clever things. So this OS, optimized for size, I think usually produces the most sort of straightforward human assembly code just because it's trying to be short. That's usually what you're doing when you're writing assembly, is doing some of the most compact thing. If we use -O2, which is optimization level 2, which is trying to be fast, this is the code we get. Now, it does this trick where it loads the end of A into a register. Rather than keeping track of I, it gets rid of I and turns this into a loop where it has a pointer to A, and it compares the pointer to the address at the end of A. And this gets rid of the variable I and saves one register basically over the entire loop. That's a pretty non-obvious transformation. Like, you could do that by hand in C. Like, you'd write, you know, long star P equals A and long star N equals A plus N and do while P is less than or equal to N or something like that. Like, you could write this by hand, but it's not a very obvious transformation. And it does improve performance very slightly, even though it's a lot of work to do the transformation. And our compiler knows to do it by hand. Someone writing the compiler said, oh, it's very common to iterate through arrays with an index, and you can get rid of the index, and that helps performance out. And they wrote the code to identify this case in general and do this transformation. Yeah. And that's a surprisingly tricky thing to do that improves performance. So, questions about what's going on here? So, given that compilers can do this, the natural question is, well, we're talking about optimization techniques, why don't we just have the compiler do it? And compilers do a good job, and, you know, you do have to remember to turn them on, so that's one lesson here. Like, if you want fast code, you probably should ask your compiler for fast code, or you won't get it. But compilers and humans are good at different kinds of optimizations. And we'll talk about a bunch of optimizations that compilers sometimes have trouble doing, and we'll discuss what are the things that keep our compilers from optimizing our code the way we'd expect. Because while the compiler did that clever transformation there, there are other optimizations which, to a human, seem a lot more obvious and easy to do, which you'll find out your compiler won't do. And there are reasons for that. So, I have a sort of broad list of compiler limitations. These are things that restrict what the compiler can do. And one of the big ones, which seems kind of obvious, is that the compiler needs to generate code that does the same thing as the code that's written. Right? The optimized code needs to be the same in effect as the unoptimized code. Well, that's obvious, of course. You know, you wouldn't be happy if your optimization didn't do that. But the compiler needs to get this right, even in corner cases, cases where you looking at the code would say, no one would call this function that way. You know, the compiler needs to do that. You know, and this includes simple things like, if you look at this code, the compiler needs to worry about what if n is negative. You might conclude no one's going to call this with a negative number. But there's a particular thing this function does when n is negative, and the compiler needs to do that. So another thing is that compilers often work a method at a time. So optimization often, for that compilers do, often involves, let's look for some pattern in code, and that gets very computationally expensive to do over a lot of code. Like, you have to look for, you know, if you want to say eliminate, you know, loop indices, you can think of the analysis as being, look at every loop, look at everything in the loop that might be an index, and everything that might use it as an address, and like, check all of them. And if you do this across methods, that can become very expensive when you're looking for patterns like that, or between methods, So compilers just often won't do it for cost reasons, that it's a make your compile times very long. If every time you call like five functions in the file, the compiler needs to look into those, merge them with the thing you're calling, and figure out, is there some optimization I can do here? It often just won't do it, because A, usually there isn't, and B, like it takes a long time. You can quickly grow a small loop into like many hundreds of lines of code to look at. Another reason is that if your methods are in different files, well, your compiler typically works a file at a time, and that's a reason it won't look inside a method that's in another file. It doesn't know what that method is when it's compiling. So compilers sometimes have a feature called link time optimization to get around the issue of things aren't in another file, but this is not the default, and well, it makes producing executables a lot slower. Because now every time you change any object file, the compiler is going to do something where it looks at all the object file code and reanalyzes it to try to fix it up and make it better. Other thing is the compilers don't know what your values will be. So for example, if we look at this loop here, you might, as a human, say, well, n is probably going to be pretty big in cases which matter. That is not obvious to the compiler. The compiler can have heuristics to figure that out, but the compiler has no evidence that n is going to be big versus n is usually like between 1 and 4. And you obviously want to do different things in those two cases. And another thing is that there's these trade-offs between code size and speed. So a lot of the optimizations we'll talk about increase code size, increase how big the assembly is. And we saw this with cache blocking. If you look at just the C code, it's way bigger with cache blocking. So if you did cache blocking on something where it didn't improve performance much, maybe the matrices are small, you just made your program way bigger for no reason. And the compiler can't really tell the cases where making your program bigger is going to help or not in many cases, because it doesn't understand like what your notion of you can make this function really big, that's fine, is versus this function isn't called very much, I don't care. Please just make my executable not take up like 10 megabytes. Okay, so any questions about these limitations? Okay. So mentioned that we have these corner cases, and I'm going to talk about probably the most pernicious corner case which keeps compilers from doing optimizations. So there's lots of cases where you'll say, yeah, the compiler obviously can do something about that, where this problem we're talking about, which is aliasing, prevents it. So let's take the example from our textbook of aliasing. We have a function which takes a pointer px and py. It adds px to py twice. And you might say, well, okay, so you load py into a register, and you multiply it times 2 and you add it to px. That seems straightforward. That should do what this function does. But this is an incorrect translation of this function. The compiler is not allowed to generate this because that is not what this function does. And the problem is that px and py could point to the same thing. So in this example, the result should be 4, because we'll do x plus equals x to make x2, then x plus equals x to make x4. But the code generated that the wrong code I showed you there, where we multiply x times 2 and add it to x, well, that's going to give us 3. It's the wrong answer. So this is wrong code to generate, even though you really say, I don't really want to access py twice. Why would we do that? But the compiler needs to worry about this. So the compiler is not allowed to generate this code, even though as a human, you're going to say, well, calling this with the same pointer twice, that doesn't seem to make much sense. And you probably would just do that. The compiler can't do that because you would be angry if you were relying on this corner case, if your compiler made this assumption. So you might say this is very contrived, right? This doesn't seem like a real scenario we would have. But aliasing happens in non-contrived circumstances. It's all over real code. So let's look at an example here. So if we look at result of row, when the compiler is generating this code, the compiler needs to worry, what if, you know, result equals, you know, matrix plus k? What if they're both pointers to the same array? The compiler needs to worry about that. And that means when the compiler's looking at this top loop, it's not really going to be able to do the transformation I showed you here, where it keeps this sum in a register, adds it up in the register, and then stores it in the result array. Because in the case where the result and matrix point to the same parts of the same thing, that can produce the wrong answer. Yeah?
Would it be too much computation to check the actual address before doing the operation?
So the question is, would it be too hard to check the address? And the answer is, the compiler absolutely could generate code to do that. So, and that is something that some compilers in some scenarios will do. Note that that means you now have a check of that as part of the function, so it has a bit of overhead, but it does allow the compiler to do this. And those checks become more and more complicated the more pointers you have lying around in your code. But yes, compilers do have the option of adding a check and generating both versions of the code. But you know, that check might take some time. So for example, if n is small, that check's not worth it. Also, that makes our code a lot bigger, because now we have basically two copies of the loop. And if you're worried about why are you making my executable 10 megabytes, you'd complain if the compiler did that all the time. But yes, that is an option, and when you ask for aggressive optimization, some compilers will generate those sorts of checks. But you, as a human, have the option of doing the straightforward thing of just making an explicit local variable, right? You're just telling the compiler what you mean in a more explicit way, and you're telling it in a way where it doesn't, where it's obvious because it's a local variable, it knows, well, you never took a pointer to that local variable. It can't possibly be pointed to by result or matrix, because it's a local pointer with no, yeah, which never had this address taken. That's an easy thing for compilers to figure out, but two pointers, really hard. And this makes a difference in performance. So compiling with GCC 5.4 with -02, we get an actual difference in the number of cycles per iteration. Or per addition. So we get an actual number of difference. And when we're going to higher optimization levels, we get a bigger difference. And what happens here is that often knowing that aliasing doesn't happen allows compilers to do more aggressive optimizations. In particular, the reason we have this big dip in performance is the compiler figured out how to use instructions which add multiple numbers at once to do this, but it couldn't figure out how to do that when it had to worry about what if result and matrix overlap, what if, you know, I have to make sure I get the sum into, you know, worry about what if I'm summing up, the next value I'm summing is, you know, in the matrix. Yes, and as you said, the compiler could do this overlap check. Like, it could generate this overlap check, but it generally won't. Just because that's a lot of extra code to generate, and it won't always help. So this aliasing problem also comes up with our cache optimizations. You might say, cache blocking, that seems like a pattern that's pretty automatic to do. Like, the transformation, once you know what it is, you don't need to understand why it works to do it. You just adjust the loops in a particular way, and it just works. So why doesn't the compiler do it itself? So let's start with the simplest cost optimization we did, which was reordering loops, right? We just talked about some loop orders are better than others because they change the locality. So maybe the compiler could figure that out. And that's a problem, actually, because in this code, the compiler needs to worry, what if B and A are parts of the same array? So what if, for example, B points to 10 elements into A? The compiler then needs to reason about, well, does changing the loop order would actually change the answer in that case? Probably. So the compiler can't generate the same code for both of these because there is a case where they have different answers. We as humans know, well, obviously you aren't passing the same matrix, but the compiler isn't told that. So similarly, because of this aliasing in the code like this, the compiler can't do some other things we'd like it to do to speed up code. So one thing we'd like the compiler to do here, for example, is we'd like the compiler to keep, you know, say, bij in a register. But this problem makes that very hard. What if bij and ai times n plus k end up being the same element? The compiler needs to worry that that might happen, and that's going to make it hard for it to transform this code into, you know, float bij equals dot dot dot, and then bij plus equals, and then bi times n plus j equals that temporary. Like, that's what you want the compiler to do, where that temporary float is in a register. But the compiler can't really do that, because it needs to prove that, well, I'm not missing a case where one of the A's I'd be summing up would have changed because of that, because I don't know whether or not B and A overlap, which is the same, you know, same problem we saw here, right? That I have two arrays I know are distinct, but the compiler doesn't know, so it's not going to be able to do the simple thing and put things in registers. It's also not going to be able to do this more complicated cache optimization we talked about, reordering loops, even if it knows what order would be best, because it needs to worry about these corner cases. So like we saw here, where I can explicitly write a local variable for things I went kept in registers, when you're writing code that deals with things like matrices, you want to do that too. That if you want things in registers that are used multiple times, you want to actually write local variables so the compiler knows that that's possible. Because otherwise, the compiler is going to worry, hey, you're accessing these array elements. What if I have this problem where where that value changes? So for example, a common thing you might see for matrix code is that here's our cache block code where I've extracted the values from A into local variables. And this you can think of as an idea is that, you know, keep in register, please. Right? We're saying keep that value in a register. I know it's not going to change because, you know, I know that please, you know, this doesn't conflict with the IJ, with BIJ. I know it doesn't conflict with BIJ, and I'm telling the compiler that by just explicitly loading the value, telling it keep that value that you load once, and hopefully it can keep it in the register. And I can do the same thing in the inner loop here, where I say I'm loading AKJ, two elements for AKJ, just keep them in a register. Don't worry about those assignments to B changing them. They're not going to. And this is how I can give the compiler the information it needs to, in order to now not reload these elements from A over and over again, which it would have done before with my simpler cache block code. where I was accessing these array elements explicitly. So does this make sense? So in both these cases, we have aliasing, which makes it hard for the compiler to keep things in registers. And our solution is to remove this thing that would have been loaded repeatedly outside the loop or the sequence of things which load it repeatedly and into a local variable. And that local variable tells the compiler, hey, this thing is not aliased. And it knows that because, hey, you never took a pointer to the local variable. Its value can't possibly change. It knows it can load it once into a register and keep it there. So does this transformation make sense? So if you look at real matrix code, this is commonly the sort of pattern you'll see it being written in. So they'll do cache blocking, and in the innermost loop, they'll do this sort of, let's have local variables for everything. This is often called register blocking. You can think of this as being that idea of explicitly choosing what's in the cache. Here, we're explicitly choosing what's in registers. And we're doing that by telling the compiler their local variables. And hopefully the compiler will take the hint. So I've talked about these problems with aliasing, and our workaround is just create local variables to tell the compiler when to load things into register so the compiler knows that things don't overlap, and for things like loop reordering, well, you have to do it yourself. There is a feature in C and C++, which is supposed to let you tell compilers just, hey, these things don't alias. It's called the restrict keyword. And it says, I promise this pointer doesn't alias another in the same piece of code. And if it does, you messed up. The result is undefined behavior. The compiler is allowed to generate code that takes liberal advantage of that assumption. So you might say, well, maybe this will help the compiler do the optimization itself. And you could try that. I have found, usually, that compilers are really, really bad at using this hint. Really, really bad. I occasionally gotten them to do it, but usually not. Usually it does nothing. And this is the syntax. It's a keyword applied to a pointer, which means it goes after the star. And yes, that is surprising because you probably haven't seen it before in C or C++. Okay, so let's talk about another set of things compilers don't do well. So mention that we don't look into methods and we don't understand code versus speed size trade-offs. So there's one common easy optimization that would be easy for compilers to do except for these problems. So let's look at this code here. So we have here an add with limit. So we have some utility function that adds, but if we get over 10,000, we just get 10,000. And we just use it in a loop. So we call it here. And the natural way of compiling this is that we're going to do something like this. We're going to load the two arguments and call the function. So that means that even though our add with limit function is quite simple, that we're going to have these four extra instructions. We're going to have two moves, a call, and in the function itself, a return. So every iteration of this loop, we're executing four extra instructions to call this function, which probably has in total, usually two instructions it executes, two or three. So that's actually a lot of overhead. So we're doing three instructions of work with seven instructions. So add, compare, conditional jump, plus these two moves, a call and a return. And we, by hand, can fix this. We could just put the function inside. And this is a very mechanical transformation. So this is really easy for compilers to do, except they need to know it's a good idea, and they need to have the source code of the function available. So if add with limit here is in another file, well, where does the compiler, how does the compiler know what it does? It has to generate a function call. And, you know, the compiler also needs to know it's a good idea. So one question is, why isn't this always a good idea? What's the problem? Why don't I always want to do this? When I have this loop here, why don't I always want to put the function inside that loop? Yeah, so what's size of my code would increase, and what's going to be bad about that eventually? So the size of our code would increase. It's this size trade-off. So even from a performance perspective, that can be bad. Because eventually, our code will get too big for the instruction cache. So if like we inline functions all over the place, it may end up being slower. We also have the problem that if I care about giving someone my executable, well, now it's huge if I inline functions everywhere. And this is especially true if like I inline it and the loop has like two iterations. You know, I'm getting very little speed benefit, but I'm making the code I have to keep around bigger. There's another advantage of inlining that I didn't mention explicitly, that in addition to saving these call and return and move to set up arguments instructions, we also make there be more free registers for the compiler. Because now the compiler doesn't need to, you know, leave EDI and ESI free, which it's not using. It can use them for something else, and this can dramatically improve performance, you know, and combine with, you know, moving values into registers instead of accessing them over and over again from memory. So I told you this is a mechanical transformation, and it is something compilers will do. But compilers will have these limitations on when they do inlining because they're concerned about the cons. They're concerned about they might make your code slower because you'll have more instruction cache misses because, you know, you'll have too much machine code for the instruction cache eventually if you inline all the time. And they usually won't inline across .o files because, well, if add with limit is in another .c file, they don't know what it is. And you might change it before you make the executable. They can't inline it then. So unless you like pass special options, they won't try to inline across .o files. So they typically have this heuristic that if the function call is small enough, they'll inline it. So they'll measure the number of instructions. If it's small, they'll inline it. If it's not, they'll assume it's not worth it. Even though it might still save some time. They'll just assume it's not worth it if it's too big. They'll also often have a special case where if you have a function which is called exactly once, like only once in the entire program, only once in the entire file and it's like not global, they can inline that function and get rid of the definition of it that doesn't waste any space. And some compilers do have hints to say, hey, this is a function that I've written, please inline it. Or this is a function that I've written, please don't inline it. Because it's something that's easy for the compiler to do, so you can mark a function with that hint. What the hint is depends on what compiler you're using, but that's a common feature. Because it's a, you know, nice thing that you can know this function is worth inlining or this isn't. Because you know like if it's used in an important loop or not. So any questions about function inlining? Okay, so let's talk about another issue that compilers sometimes have trouble dealing with. That is probably the biggest impact optimization, if you can do it, but often doesn't come up. So here, I have some code that has bad performance. So what's the problem? I'm doing a lot more work than I should be doing. In fact, I'm doing asymptotically more work than I should be doing. Yes. Okay, so I'm comparing that string len every iteration. And what's bad about that? So why does that take a lot of time?
What you can do is initialize it beforehand.
Okay, so you're telling me about the fix, which is good. But why is string len strings expensive?
String len goes through the length of the string every time you call it.
Yeah, so the way string len works is it finds the null terminator. So it iterates through the string. So this is actually big O of n squared because of this. That is big O of n, and we're doing it n times. So this is super slow. And if our compiler can't look inside stringlen, it can't know that, oh, stringlen's going to do the same thing every time. Right? As far as our compiler is concerned, stringlen's in another file. It has to assume it does some magic with the pointer and possibly like global variables. Like maybe stringlen's implementation, as far as the compiler knows, is that it looks at the pointer and then returns a random number. You know, that would be something you could write a function that does and call it stringlen. We know that's not what it does, but the compiler doesn't, so it's going to call it every time. So you do the transformation you mentioned of store it in a local variable and take it out. And in the cases where compilers can't look inside functions or don't have like some built-in heuristic where it knows, oh, I know what this function does, which it does for some standard library functions, but for your functions it won't, doing this will be helpful because the compiler doesn't know that stringlen does the same thing every time, and it's not going to know that your function does the same thing every time in general. So this is the biggest win because it's, you know, this is a big O improvement and it comes up in real code. So there's another case of the same idea, which is less obvious, of a sort of optimization you might do. So how can I get rid of some comparison? So in this code, I compare I plus amount to n a lot of times, and there turns out to be a relatively simple thing I can do to do that a lot less. To do a lot less comparisons, I guess I should say. So we might, you know, we'll just do a lot less comparisons. So what can we do to help out with that? Yeah.
Set a variable for that that's already I plus the amount.
Okay. Set a variable when I plus the amount becomes true. So your observation is that initially I plus amount is less than n, and then it becomes not less than n. And we don't need to check it anymore. So yes, one option is you could have a flag variable which stores whether that comparison was ever true. And if it wasn't, we check it again. Otherwise, we just know it's not true. So we can do a little bit better than that and turn it into two loops. So then we don't even have a flag variable to check. And this is sort of a common thing that, you know, ends up helping code, is that if you have multiple cases in a loop, if you can make them separate loops, well, that eliminates this redundant work where we're checking this condition where we could have pre-computed when it's true. Like in this case, we know it's true for this range, so I'm just saying, I know in advance that that's the first range has it true, then I know it's always true. I can do that as a separate loop, so I don't, in the second loop, I'm not checking again. Like I already know I'm not checking. Not even checking a flag variable. So any questions about this transformation from here to here? And this comes up a bunch in real code, like if you imagine like you have corners on something, like in a matrix you have the edges, you want to do something different. This is an example where this issue comes up. It's beneficial to not like iterate through a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix and every item say, are we at a corner? If so, I need to do something different. So one introduction to one final optimization technique. And this is something called loop unrolling. And this is another thing that compilers could easily do, but often won't do because of these sorts of concerns. Because they don't know like what methods do, they don't know if they're important, and they can't really predict, you know, what your notion of trade-offs are as far as inputs and code size. So the transformation looks like this. So we have a loop here, we do a comparison, we check the condition, and we add one value. So this is just add a whole bunch of values. sum up a whole bunch of values. Sum, you know, this is sum each value. Here, we add two values at once. So we just add one value, then we add the next value in the array. And so we're doing twice as much work, and we have the same number of loop iterations. And note that most of our assembly instructions, we have loop. So this is four instructions of loop overhead. And we still have four instructions of loop overhead afterwards, but for those four instructions, now we're doing twice as much work. So we're missing a couple things. So I have this comment, plus handle leftover. What am I referring to there? What am I missing from this code that I actually need to do? Yeah. Yeah, so I'm taking pairs of items and adding them together. That is wrong if I have an odd number of things. Like, I have to have that leftover item, it needs to be added, I better not add what's in memory after the end of the array. So I need some special code to handle that. And you can write that in assembly. I'm not going to show the assembly for that. Instead, I will show the equivalent C. So this is sort of the explicit version of this code in C. Our first version is just a for loop where we sum one item. Second version, we sum ai and ai plus one. And then we have to worry about, oh, what if I had an odd element? So you can see that to handle that, I'm comparing I plus one to n, which for making good assembly might end up being comparing I to n minus one. That might be what the compiler actually generates, we hope. But then I have to handle the odd element out. So this handling the odd element out is a bit of an extra cost because we have a few extra comparisons if n is small. But if n is large, we're saving a lot of work. We're saving these four instructions that we have to pay. We're doing a lot less of them in total. Like n is 1,000, we're doing 500 times 4 versus 1,000 times 4. Of these extra instructions. So we're saving instructions, and hopefully that means we're saving time. And I did show this with doing two, unrolling for two elements. We could, of course, do that for more than two, which would just generate a longer sequence of add instructions and a little bit more complicated code to deal with any leftover items. Does this make sense? So this is a nice, easy transformation, and it saves instructions, and probably, you know, improves our performance because it saves instructions. And it's actually really easy for compilers to do. You can do it very mechanically. You might say, well, you're changing I to I plus one. Isn't that hard to figure out? Well, you could just do I plus one, and you're still saving instructions, right? We could, instead of what we have here, you know, if we're worried about this being too complicated, we could instead write, do this add, and then inc rdx, do the same add, and then inc rdx, and we save one less instruction, but we're still saving instructions because we still save the compare and the jump, as long as we can figure out the, you know, leftover case. But it turns out that compilers have good ways of doing that. But they don't do it that much. And the big issues with just automatically doing this transformation on all loops is, well, if the loop has a small number of iterations, it can be slower. Like if n is typically 3 and we're doing this, well, we're doing this needless comparison which doesn't matter and waste time, and then doing the normal loop. Like, we're wasting time. If n is typically 5, we're doing one iteration of that loop and then another comparison. We have probably extra work to do. And also, loop unrolling makes code a lot bigger, especially if our loop is more than just an addition. Like if our loop has a bunch of work in it, we're making lots of copies of that. If we went to like unroll like 4 times or 8 times, our code gets a lot bigger. This is probably worse than function inlining. And we could easily, if we do this all over the place, run out of instruction cache space, especially if we're unrolling lots of loops which have very few iterations. We could easily just run out of space in our instruction cache and make the program slower overall. So for this reason, we won't always, we won't have compilers do this automatically. A compiler will do some amount of loop unrolling, and it's going to have heuristics like we saw for function inlining. It's going to have some way of guessing this is a loop that's worth unrolling, like because it's very small, and either maybe I know n is always large for some reason, like n is a constant, that's an easy case. But often the compiler won't do it because the downside is bad. And you can think of as a compiler writer, if turning on optimization made your code slower like 10% of the time, you'd be angry. So compilers don't take the risk. They do things which are safe. Okay. So you might say, well, so this is loop unrolling, so how much does it help? And in reality, we know it decreases instructions. So I ran basically this code with all the various amounts of unrolling on my laptop with 992 elements. I chose 992 because that number of longs fits in my L1 cache. And I also made sure I accessed them beforehand, so I'm not having any cache misses in here. Because the cases where loop rolling, unrolling really helps is when our loops are really short. So like no cache misses, no work. And here's the performance I get in cycles per element. So I just count how much time for adding each element. And you'll notice that there's some obvious signs that my machine is not our pipeline processor. So first of all, we're getting multiple instructions per cycle completed. Like my machine laptop is multiple issue. And we also see this weird effect where as we increase the amount of unrolling, we keep decreasing the number of instructions we execute per element. Which makes sense, right? We have less of these compare, increment, and so on instructions. But our performance hits this wall. And our textbook calls this the latency bound. So we can't get our performance below 1 cycle per instruction. You can't get faster than that. Cycle per element, sorry. And that's known as the latency bound. So we'll talk about after the exam what causes that and how we reason about like whether that's a problem. How we know when does loop unrolling help or when does it hurt. But because of this effect, you can see that this is another sort of limitation of loop unrolling, that you might think that if we don't have instruction cache misses, we always have better performance, a little bit better performance when we do loop unrolling, but that doesn't actually happen. We actually hit this flat where nothing else, where it doesn't improve. Okay, and that's what I have for today. So next time will be exam review. So if you want me to answer questions about any topics which may or may not be on the exam, please come with them, or else I probably won't talk about them.